Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It is about local food. Next to that, it's about regional food. Next to that, it's about national food.
Matt Ewer is the co-founder of Green Bean Delivery. It's like a grocery store meets a CSA wrapped up in a food hub. He talks about what small and mid-sized farmers get out of his business model. We kick off a series of reports from Harvest Public Media about meat in America, how it's produced, who eats it, and what the future might look like. Also, farmers are embracing the old technique of planting cover crops to protect and revitalize soil. Then, the cook's best friend is a high-powered blender. Daniel Orr gives you a good reason to invest in one with a dynamite recipe for pesto. And we meet George Hageman, retired biology professor turned beekeeper. What's happening in food and farming news? Mark Chill is with us.
California has signed into law the toughest limits on antibiotics for livestock in the U.S. The law bars the use of antibiotics that are important in human medicine to promote growth in animals raised for profit. Under the new rules, a veterinarian must approve any use of those drugs to treat sick animals and does not allow their use for preventing illness, a loophole that opponents say permits the use of antibiotics for fattening. The regulations are more stringent than federal rules, which allow use of antibiotics to prevent disease. California's new rules will not go into effect until January 1, 2018. Online magazine Grist reported that industry opposition to the bill was weak, with farmers stating that they are already following U.S. food and drug recommendations to phase out non-medical use of antibiotics. Earth Eats' Liz Leslie is on that pumpkin beat again. Earlier this fall, she reported that Libby's announced fewer pumpkins would make it into cans this year as rainy weather in Illinois has affected the pumpkin crop. Half of all pumpkins produced are canned, and overwhelmingly, those pumpkins destined for cans come from Illinois. A spokesperson for Libby's reassured consumers that there would be enough pumpkin to get through this year's Thanksgiving pie season, but the cushion of additional pumpkin will not likely be here this year. Other parts of the country saw less rain than usual. That has left Virginia farmers with pumpkins that are smaller than expected, but farmers actually point out that less rain is better than too much rain. Excess rain leads pumpkins to rot when they can't absorb all of the water. Too little rain means pumpkins improvise. Their roots go far enough into the soil to pull moisture out to grow. On the West Coast, heat caused giant pumpkins to become less, well, giant. Half Moon Bay, California hosts the Safeway World Championship Pumpkin Weigh-Off annually. And this year, the prize pumpkin weighed in at 1,969 pounds, a far cry from the previous year's 2,058 pounds. And we've reported on the Svalbard Seed Vault the past couple weeks. Chad Bouchard wrote an in-depth story about the recent withdrawal. As he puts it, anyone who stores precious files on a computer knows the mantra for avoiding catastrophe. Backup, backup, backup. That's the idea behind the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, where 750,000 unique crop samples sit frozen and buried in a permafrost bunker deep in Arctic Norway in case of disaster. The facility was built in 2008 to serve as a safeguard for other seed collections around the world. Last month, one of the facility's clients made a withdrawal. In 2012, scientists at a seed collection in Aleppo, Syria, were forced to flee to Beirut to escape escalating violence. But with ancient crop varieties hanging in the balance, the scientists at the International Center for Agricultural Research in Dry Areas, or ICARDA, risked their lives to return to the facility. Brian Lanoff is the spokesperson for Crop Trust, the company that operates the vault in Norway.
Day-to-day tasks were becoming incredibly difficult in the atmosphere in Syria. So they requested that the seeds that they had deposited to the seed vaults, about 116,000 samples, be sent to Morocco and Lebanon so they can reestablish their collection in those countries.
The bank in Aleppo held thousands of seeds that researchers could use to develop drought and heat-resistant crops. Climate scientists say that for every 1 degree of global temperature increase, crop yields will decrease by an average of 2% per decade. That figure is closer to 10% for foods like wheat and rice. You can read these articles again and share them with your friends on Facebook and Twitter and email and Pinterest and all of the various social networks you're a part of. They're collected at eartheats.org.
What do you think about these stories? That's what our Twitter feed is all about. Add your voice to the conversation at Earth Eats. Mark Chilla is the voice of our news segment. Thanks.
My pleasure.
When most Americans sit down to dinner, meat is often at the center of the table. This week, Harvest Public Media is exploring some of the big issues in how our meat is made. Today, as part of the series Choice Cuts Meat in America, reporter Grant Gerlach looks at the growing global demand for meat and how it could eat up more land.
Americans have a big appetite for everything meat. We smoke it, grill it, slice it, and chop it.
It's un American not to like it.
No surprise that's what Dan Johnson thinks. He's a grill master from Norfolk, Virginia. I ran into him slinging barbecue at Ribfest in Lincoln, Nebraska.
The treat to a meal is meat, whether it's chicken, whether it's ribs, whether it's pork.
And we eat lots of it. The typical American puts away around 200 pounds of beef, pork, and poultry every year. That's true in many of the wealthiest countries. But developing countries are now showing a growing appetite for meat, and that's setting up one of the biggest challenges for agriculture over the next few decades.
Globally, there have been very strong increases in livestock product demand.
Thomas Hertel is an agricultural economist at Purdue University.
And most of those increases have been in the poorest countries and the populous countries of the world, China, India, for example.
By 2050, there will be 9.6 billion people in the world, making for more potential meat eaters. On top of that, Hertel says, incomes are expected to rise in places like Southeast Asia and sub-Saharan Africa.
As they get more income, they spend a lot of that on livestock products, and that's what's fueled these dramatic increases in livestock product consumption in much of the world.
The United Nations estimates the world will need to produce an additional 220 million tons of meat per year by 2050. That's billions more chickens, pigs, and cows. And those animals have to eat. Mostly, they're fattened up on corn and soybeans. That means farmers from the Corn Belt to Argentina to Russia are planting massive crops and plowing up land, making big changes to the environment. Take China, where the growing middle class is hungry for meat, and livestock are hungry for corn and soybeans.
And they're importing them like mad. They're importing them from the U.S., they're importing them from Brazil and Argentina, so that you see the massive expansion into the Brazilian Cerrado.
It's going to be a race. A race against time.
Ken Kassman studies global agriculture at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. From 2002 to 2011, he says, the world plowed up another 25 million acres of land each year for farming, an area roughly the size of Indiana. He says scientists are in a race to help farmers grow enough grain without putting even more land to the plow.
Because if you can't, production of meat and crops will come from converting these natural habitats that store biodiversity and carbon. It will come at the expense of clearing those lands.
To avoid that, Kassman says global yields per acre will need to double. No small task, but he says there are parts of the world with a big production gap. The farms have good soil and good weather, but aren't raising much.
Closing the gap depends upon getting modern farming technologies into the hands of farmers.
Give them better seed, bigger machinery, more pesticides, advanced fertilizer, and they won't have to take more land. That kind of intensive agriculture has its own problems, though. The U.S. struggles with fertilizer running into rivers and streams. Science must address that, Kassman says. But there's also a risk in shying away from industrial ag.
Farming without fertilizers reduces environmental leakage of nutrients locally around a farm. But if every farmer did that, you'd have to cut the entire Amazon rainforest down.
Of course, the world wouldn't have to make so much meat if everyone ate less. In fact, meat-loving Americans have backed off a bit from beef as prices have gone up. But economist Thomas Hertel says meat is a luxury few will be willing to give up.
You could also say the best way to manage, you know, carbon emissions is don't drive cars anymore. Everyone walk to the office. Is that going to happen? No. And people aren't going to stop eating beef.
That leaves the meat industry with a lot of work to do to fill global demand. And in the meantime, there are a lot of other issues to chew on. Health concerns over how much meat Americans eat. Questions about how antibiotics are used. By the time 2050 comes around, the meat on your plate may not be that different. But the story of how it got there could be. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Check out more stories about food and farming from this reporter collective, harvestpublicmedia.org. Matt Ewer is one of the founders of Green Bean Delivery. He got his start as a food businessman when he was a youngster.
Ironically enough, I sold sweet corn door to door when I was a kid. And we had a family farm that was farmed by another family. We put sweet corn along the side of the field corn because I asked my dad when I was little, I said, where's all the corn that you can eat, right? And he explained, well, this is all for cows. But beside the point, we would go out there, harvest the sweet corn. I'd take it back to Marion, Indiana, where I'm from, fill up the van and put it in the garage. And I would literally go door to door, Red Flyer wagon. I know it's probably bringing up images of Norman Rockwell and all this stuff in your mind. People would wait on me. You know, and I started to get a reputation, and maybe that was a lesson for me at a very young age that people wanted to be connected to agriculture and people wanted to have a face with their food.
He came into the Earth Eats studios earlier this year. His business, Green Bean, is an online, on-demand grocery store where the food comes to you. A lot of it is organic and regionally sourced from mid-sized farms.
We're trying to mix the service that you get from, you know, a more streamlined grocery with the service that you can get from a CSA or a farmer's market and put those things together. And when we do that, we create a commercially viable product. And then when we turn our support over to a local farmer or an artisan, we really make impact on their business and their family farm. That's how you cultivate change.
Ewer knows what it's like for farmers. He is one. He worked at Strangers Hill Organics when he lived in Bloomington. Now he helps run two certified organic farms as part of the green bean business, one in Indiana and the other in Ohio. From the farmer's perspective, they deliver their food to one of the company's six distribution centers, Indy, Louisville, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Nashville, and Columbus, Ohio, and then Green Bean does the work of getting it to the customers. When he describes it like that, it sounds a lot like something we've talked about before on Earth Eats.
You know, food hubs are interesting conversations. I hear a lot about food hubs. We've been going since 2007, and we consider ourselves a food hub. So when I hear those conversations, oftentimes I'm like, hey, over here, you know, check us out, you know. Food hubs are not just about the brick and mortar, right? The concept of a roof over food, right? It's actually, what is the business model? And that's what we're trying to show is, you know, viable business models, market solutions to get local food, sustainable food, organic food to consumers at an affordable level, make it very accessible and easy for people to get to. So we want it to be a key, convenient, affordable, and accessible.
If you play around on the Green Bean website, you'll see organic food from the United States, but only six different foods labeled from Indiana. He says that's because farmers are still tied to the harvest season. So right now, you can score some green beans, broccoli, and spaghetti squash supplied by Indiana farms. Grapefruit, though, comes from somewhere else in the country. The website doesn't specify. And your ginger root, well, that flies in from Peru. Ewer puts it all into perspective.
It is about local food. Next to that, it's about regional food. Next to that, it's about national food. And those all come together in kind of a food security conversation, right? If California dries up, are we going to have the ability to really support ourselves, make sure we can still eat our lovely fruits and vegetables? Right now, I'd argue that we don't. What my company is trying to do is build commercial viability and business solutions and sustainability for family farms.
One more quick search on the Green Bean website. Sweet corn? Nope, it's not on the list. You'll have to wait until next summer for that to pop up again. Matt Ewer is the CEO of Green Bean Delivery. It's been around since 2007, and now it's making deliveries around southern Indiana. You can take a look for yourself at greenbeandelivery.com. Looking ahead, Chef Daniel Orr has two types of oil for this recipe.
So you don't want to waste that $16 bottle olive oil on, so you just kind of stretch it out with a little bit of the salad oil.
It could be a condiment or it could be a pesto. We'll hear more coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. and Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Good day to you. This is Earth Eats. Welcome. I'm Annie Corrigan. Generations of tilling and planting on the same land have left soil in many farm areas in poor shape. As Logan Layden reports for Harvest Public Media, many farmers worry that their livelihoods are in danger.
The superstitious Indians hated the plow. They said that plowing turned the earth upside down and ruined everything.
As this old documentary from Oklahoma TV station WKY about the Dust Bowl shows, the American Indians were right to be concerned.
The spring of 1934 was dry. Farmers had planted their wheat in the dust that fall and waited. But the winter had passed without snow. Spring began with no clouds, no rain.
The Dust Bowl was about to begin. The natural prairie had been plowed away. Drought set in. The wind did the rest. More than 800 million tons of topsoil blew away in a single year. In the decades since, farmers have planted trees, irrigated crops, and changed the way they plow to prevent another Dust Bowl, but they kept plowing, kept tilling their fields.
Tillage is incredibly intrusive. Tillage is an intrusive tool.
Ray Archuleta is an agronomist with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Part of what he does for a living is dig holes and look at dirt to chart soil health across the country.
To me, it's a national crisis. And a lot of people say, well, you're being overdramatic. I say, well, get in the vehicle with me and let's go. When you drive, Logan, through the whole country, it's very sad to see that our land is very, very diminished.
Plowing up the ground can help farmers deal with pests or control weeds, but Archuleta says tilling also excites bacteria that eat the organic matter in the soil plants thrive on and destroys root and worm pathways that allow moisture to penetrate the ground. Over time, the dirt dies, and only more land and more fertilizer keep crops growing. Jordan Shearer, who owns a farm near Slapout, Oklahoma, and works for the State Association of Conservation Districts, puts it more simply.
The problem is we're creating a desert environment by plowing the damn ground.
The solution? Researchers suggest farmers of all kinds stop tilling and rotate their cash crops with cover crops, assortments of local plants that cover the field and restore organic matter into the soil when they die. Think of it as large-scale composting. Ray Archuleta calls it farming in nature's image.
It's about mimicking nature and understanding the ecology. So it's no-till with the covers, with the animals. It's all of it as a system.
Shearer, the Slapout farmer, says moving away from that natural system is killing Oklahoma's once fertile soil.
These soils, when they were first broken out 100 years ago, probably had anywhere from 3 to 5% organic matter. Most of them are down to 1%.
When was your last rain out here? Last water.
I meet Shearer and dozens of other Oklahoma farmers in a field in western Oklahoma near a blip on the map called Leedy. They're here for a State Conservation Commission workshop on the benefits of rotating no-till wheat with cover crops.
Now, Tanner's got a jar here of the mix that we planted.
Jimmy Emmons owns this land and is talking to his fellow farmers about the cover crop of broad-leafed plants here.
We've got cowpeas, 8 pounds per acre, mung beans, 6.
Emmons' farm is used as a model as the Conservation Commission tries to spread the idea of switching to better farming practices. The attendees are all eager to learn more, like Roger Oman, who just planted his first cover crop.
Well, you know, I've been watching Jimmy. You know, he's a neighbor of mine, and my wife says, I want something green out there this summer instead of dirt. Yeah. So I said, okay, we'll try it. And it's 40 acres, and I said, shoot, we'll try it, and we'll start playing with the deal. Who knows? That might be all we do in the future. You know?
There are hurdles to making the move away from traditional farming. New equipment is expensive, and the transition takes time. But these farmers see the need for change.
We'll load up on the buses and we'll go to the last stop.
Still, old habits die hard. Archuleta says right now only about 25% of U.S. cropland is no-till and less than 1% have cover crops. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Logan Layden.
The story was produced by State Impact Oklahoma. It's about time to start thinking about bringing your herb pots inside before the first frost hits. Or you could do one last big harvest and make this recipe. Daniel Orr is in the kitchen with us for this listener-requested dish.
Well, one of the things that I really, really like to have on hand pretty much all the time are different sauces that I can paint my plates with. So we use a red pepper coulis, we make a curry vinaigrette, and then one of the other great things I try to always have around is an herb oil. So the basic recipe has some basil, really nice fresh basil. We get ours from Good Life Farms up near Martinsville. It's a living basil, so it comes to us with the roots on. Then I've got some parsley, just Italian parsley, which is the flat leaf parsley. And then today I'm going to add some baby arugula. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to blanch these greens, which means to quickly cook them in boiling salted water. And then we're going to shock them, which is to cool them down quickly in an ice bath. All right, so now you can see I've dropped those in, blanched them, and they just kind of look like some wilted spinach now. A little darker green color. Drop that in our blender. Now, I didn't really squeeze it out too much. I left a little bit of the liquid in there from the blanching. And now we're going to add our flavorings, which are a little bit of pinch of sea salt, some of our nice freshly ground black pepper, crack open a nice head of garlic, and we're going to smash that down and drop that in. I'm going to add just a couple slices of jalapeno to give us a touch of heat. And then we've got a cup of salad oil, a half cup of olive oil. The salad oil is a neutral flavor, and the olive oil has that really nice extra virgin punch. But if you used 100% olive oil, it might be a little bit too strong. Plus, you've got all these other flavors going on, so you don't want to waste that $16 bottle olive oil on. So you just kind of stretch it out with a little bit of the salad oil. And we're just going to puree that up. We'll put it into overdrive, and that's basically it. Okay, then, as always, we like to give it a little taste. And it is delicious.
He puts this oil into squeeze bottles and decorates the plates before he sends them out to customers. You can store this in plastic containers and then freeze them. You can also add some pumpkin seeds to this recipe, and then you've got a pesto. A lot of different ways to make this your own. Find the recipe at eartheats.org. Southern Indiana provides a delicious variety of nectariferous plants for bees to feast upon. That's part of why, George Hageman says, his hives at the Bloomington Community Orchard have thrived. Many young enthusiasts consider Hageman an elder statesman of Bloomington's growing beekeeping scene. We don our bee veil and join him as he checks on his two hives.
My name is George Hageman, and I'm the consultant in charge, I guess you could say, of the two honeybee hives at the Bloomington Community Orchard. Watch what happens when you give them smoke. They go down and they stick their noses in the honeycomb and fill up. That's to get them so that they can't sting. This came about because when the orchard was being established, people thought, well, gee, we've got all these fruit trees and bushes and they're going to need pollination. And if you've got a rainy week when the apples are blossoming and you've got 40 acres of orchard, you'd better have honeybees in there or else you're not going to get a crop. For almonds in Indiana, melons get pollinated, cucumbers, cherries up north, all the apples in Michigan, and various orchards in Indiana are typically pollinated by honeybees. So they're busy. They're busy. And this is just a good area to keep bees. I mean, you can make quite a bit of honey here.
What was your tipping point? What was the time in your life, if you remember a story, where you thought, and now I must work with bees?
Oh, geez. I don't think there was any single point. When I was a youngster, there was a neighbor a few houses down who kept bees, and I'd go down and I'd bother him. But he was very patient, and he would tell me what he was doing and why he did it. And one time I caught a swarm for him. The swarm emerges from the hive when the bees are reproducing, and the old queen leaves with about half the bees and hangs up in a bush or a tree for at least a few hours, sometimes a day or two, until the scouts find a new hollow tree for them to go off and live in. And if you can catch them at that point, you can come along with an empty hive and dump them in, and they'll usually stay because they think, oh, here's the hollow tree.
So you did that as a kid?
I did that, and that sort of settled me. I thought, oh, gee whiz, this is a great way to be a local hero and play with all these wonderful buzzing insects. Oh, typically maybe once a week, but I really don't have to. I go out there periodically and check them out, harvest them, the honey, mow around the beehive. But that's it. It's there's nothing magical about it. There's a lot of interest on campus and in town in general. Two other people who sell honey in the farmer's market that's locally produced. So it's not a dying art. It's there's some resurgence of interest. And because of that, and because of the fact that people are interested in locally produced foods, and they're interested in hobbies like beekeeping, apparently, too, I have high hopes that I'll pass the torch to future beekeepers.
Thanks so much to Earth Eats intern Kate Griebel for this story. Find more profiles, recipes, and news stories at eartheats.org. Here's where we usually thank all our producers and editors and bloggers, but they take a back seat today to you. Thank you for all the love and support you've shown Earth Eats over the years. From listening every week to contributing to the Twitter feed to making our recipes, this is quite the community. Hope you'll take a couple minutes right now and invest in this community. A couple bucks a month or a couple bucks per show. Go to eartheats.org, click on the red Give Now button in the upper right. It means a lot, and thanks. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. That's another one in the books. Next week, same time, shall we? I'm Annie Corrigan.